What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Phil Gibson, aka Mr. Sue, hosts the podcast A Boy Named Sue, and he's the singer-songwriter behind the Economic Earworm ETF, and author of the article Economic Earworms of the Sound Money Revolution, which was published in Citadel 21, Volume 6. And he's on a mission to plant these earworms through musical fusion worldwide into people's earholes. Phil Gibson, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, man. I'm super excited to talk to you. I've kind of heard your I've definitely heard your podcast. I've seen you on Twitter, but it wasn't really until I got to know you a little bit better on Clubhouse. And when I say get to know you, I mean, but just by listening to you, it wasn't that we were always interacting or very much, but I was in a lot of rooms early on where you were in the room. And for me, you just kind of had the coolest vibe. And what I mean by that is you seemed very in the moment and present and at ease with the nature of definitely that medium. And I was just intrigued. Then I read your article and I really kind of wanted to just dig into this whole music thing because music is such an important part of my life. And I want to see it more in the culture. And I want to kind of find out where you're coming from and what you think about what's going on with music and the culture. So,
yeah, let's dig into it wherever you want to start.
Well, I'd love to start, you know, with you and definitely the music that you've been doing. I want to talk about your video and your song, but maybe, you know, how long has music been a big part of your life? And when was it more than just, you know, bopping around or enjoying tunes to something more meaningful?
Man, I'd say as far back as I can remember, like even before I was playing guitar at age 10, I always loved music. Those earworms of the mid to late 90s, like as a little kid growing up, I remember sitting in the back seat of my dad's truck. It was like an extended cab, so it was like the half doors, and I was sitting on like the side where like the window is. But I just remember freaking out to those earworm songs by like Matchbox 20, Third Eye Blind, and Sugar Ray and Smash Mouth, which were great. Like, you know, maybe some people think that's like, I don't know, you know, just too cheesy or too corporate or like whatever, but. No, a good song is a good song, and that's going to stick with you. And yeah, ever since I was a kid, I was always singing, and I was in choir throughout junior high and high school just because it was like an elective. And my parents were like, well, you're decent at that. Stick with that. I'm like, okay. But it was always a part of me. And I just wanted to always push that out of me. And it was a way for me to just, you know, wrap my feelings and questions and understanding of topics in a way that kind of represented the way I was trying to learn and understand them. And that's kind of what I did with the ETF song, standing for End the Fed, but I think it was a cool double entendre with the whole everyone goes crazy about Bitcoin ETF, but it's funny as more come out in Canada and there's more talks about them. And even with Coinbase having their IPO or whatever the hell they did, direct to market, it's just kind of like as Bitcoiners we're just kind of jaded because like it helps, but at the end of the day, you know, with a fixed supply, the price just kind of speaks for itself. And as Matt O'Dell says, it's designed to pump forever. But back to music.
Yeah,
started playing guitar when I was 10, really influenced by again that music, that 90s stuff that I still listen to today. But it wasn't until I was around that age, 10, I started listening to a lot heavier, like artist-specific and watching hours of documentaries of bands that influenced me, like Guns N' Roses and Green Day and Led Zeppelin and Blink-182, and the list goes on. And I really don't play and write as much as I'd like to, because I always kind of have been a realist that not everyone can be a rock and roll star, or it's just different because technology is disrupting a lot of industries, as it should. I think that we've all learned just after this whole COVID nonsense, it was kind of a long time coming that we needed some accelerator to maybe further get us to where society should be as far as technology, and everyone just getting used to Zoom. And as Jeff Booth talks about, like, this whole technology is inevitable. And really, no matter how much the monetary manipulators try to, you know, keep doing what they're doing with inflation, like, technology is a deflationary force that's always going to be something that's fighting against the system. And that's what we're seeing after, you know, nearly 13 years with Bitcoin, is that it strives to survive and really push the limits of the, you know, it like money's the foundation of society, and it's hopefully bringing us to a proper great reset that we actually need. Not one that's done by central planners, but one that was birthed from the free market and the innovation of old technology, but just implementing and iterating on it over time to create the magic that is Bitcoin. So probably didn't talk enough about music there, just because this is what Bitcoin does. It just kind of takes over your mind for positive reasons, of course. But where would you like to go from there?
Well, there's so much I want to take from that and pull apart, but, you know,
yeah.
I think there's a confluence that you got out there with that technology, money, and music all being languages or ways of creating deflation or kind of creating abundance, maybe. And we can bring in fiat, and, you know, it's, you know, I would argue that maybe music has changed not as well or not as good because of fiat. And, you know, technology has been great for music, but also maybe, you know, made it more abundant and maybe even cheapened. And I'm kind of curious on that note, when did you start thinking about music in terms of its ideas? And yeah.
What do you mean by ideas?
Like the ideas that it conveyed in the song, or, you know, not so much the narrative earworms that come from music. Was like, I know you have a big reverence maybe for the Green Day album, American Idiot, and some of the things they go in there. And, you know, for me, like when I would listen to music, there's a lot going on here in terms of like, one, I love music. It's the soundtrack of my life, but I never played. I never sang.
Yeah.
But the ideas were always really important to me, on par with the music. And
yeah,
it's driven a lot of times, like what I listen to and how I listen to music. And then just thinking about our conversation, I revisited a lot of music I would listen to either early growing up or like the music that really stuck with me from my teens. And one of the notions I thought about is like my curiosity for music probably declined when I was 25 or after 25. My curiosity or my time to find new music.
Same.
And my faith that I would find anything worth my time looking for.
I think, well, you mentioned curiosity and you get jaded after that, but thankfully, because there is such a oversaturation of musicians out there, bands, and we're so blessed with, you know, technology being able to, you know, like streaming and people putting on out content for free, even though that we have to pay for like premium Spotify or whatever. We have this abundant catalog of everything that we can, you know, do our own homework and like discovery on. So lately, like you mentioned that, you know, you stopped looking for stuff when you were 25, and honestly, like at that age and even before, I was getting a little jaded. Like music, I really use as a drug for exercising, like running, whatever. Same. And then and then slowly podcasts started to replace that a little bit because I felt like I needed to, again, this goes back to the abundance. I think it was Jeffrey Tucker, through like the Mises Institute, he was influenced to put everything out for free as far as like a Rothbard book. So I listened to For New Liberty like backwards and forwards for free because it was on there, because I felt like I really needed to learn how the world works and find truth. And I was trying to do that as later in high school, because I just felt like I wasn't equipped with the right knowledge to like survive in life. And I felt like I was kind of the only one that was curious, like growing up in high school, about like how things really work and what the truth is. And when it comes to politics and how the world works, like I grew up, I guess, like in a conservative, like right wing family, like, you know, they just voted that way because it made sense to them. And I'm just like, okay, well, I need to find some like a balance. So I listened to everything from fucking like Rush Limbaugh and like Sean Hannity and like Buck Sexton on the right, and later like Stephen Crowder. And then I would also try to fill in everything I could listen to like on NPR and like find like what the real truth is. And then I eventually found libertarianism because Stephen Crowder had a comedian on named Owen Benjamin, and I started watching his live streams, and he threw out names like Dave Smith, who does the Part of the Problem podcast. And that is really when the scales fell from my eyes, and it wasn't a left or right issue. It's the state. It is the coercive arm of just having the monopoly of everyone's lives. And of course that stems from having monopoly over the money, of course. But Dave Smith throwing out names like Scott Horton, that sent me down the foreign policy rabbit hole. And just all the trickery that that the people buy into, like being lied into wars, not just the Iraq war. We were pretty much lied into every war before that. I feel like after reading Creature from Jekyll Island, like every war is a banker's war. I mean, both World War I and II was to just like make good on the loans that the United States gave out to both sides of that war. And it just really emphasizes what the corruption of money has over societies. And it's just a really interesting turn of events, how it's funny to think that fiat's only like 50 years old or whatever. If you want to start with like going off the gold standard, I mean, there were always derivatives and just, you know, these claims on money and just credits before that. But, you know, when you actually go off a quote unquote like gold standard of whatever, even though they were pretty much like insolvent with gold like years before that, I think it's coming to where the hens are actually going to come home to roost at some point, or we're going to actually be living through MMT, which arguably I think it's kind of the same thing as we are, but they're just being honest about how they're screwing you with the money. but yeah, if you want to bring it back to music, it was funny because that album American Idiot, like I didn't exactly know about like the world. And after going down the foreign policy rabbit hole and Scott Horton, just learning how anti-war I could actually like become, because it's so hard to sympathize with something like that, because it's just so far away from where we are in America or Canada or wherever. If you're not actually on the grounds there and you don't understand how inflation is really working behind the scenes and is bankrupting everyone and destroying the middle class just to fund these wars to keep the military industrial complex going, which, you know, it's scary that if you think about it, like the military industrial complex not only benefits the big cats at Boeing, Raytheon, whatever, but you know, that keeps politicians elected, but it also keeps like blue collared workers keeps them hired as well, because they're going and like making those weapons, and like no one really thinks about it at that level, and really no one thinks about the negative effects of money. And so just learning more about Bitcoin, and especially after last March, like March 15th, it was just kind of the pinch I needed to really question myself, how does like the monetary system really work? Like I get like we need ideally free market economics to take out the corporations that are too big to fail and not have those bailouts and everything. But that's really what the ETF song was. It was me piecing through everything that I was listening to on podcasts and DMing people and asking them questions and really trying to understand everything and everything that I've grown to love and enjoy as far as Bitcoin itself and free open source software and history and the corruption of money over time. And it all this stuff is really difficult to try to explain, you know, because they don't teach you this stuff in school. You have to seek this out in the first place. And you may not be able to learn it in a roughly 3.5 minute song, but that's kind of what my mission was. And if you didn't gather anything from it, then at least you would be able to walk away with something that was at least catchy.
Yeah, I think you did a fantastic job of making it very catchy. You distilled ideas really concisely, which is, you know, to write any kind of hit song is really difficult. That, you know, like you were saying before, you know, you were name dropping some bands that people could be, I don't think controversial is the right word, but, you know, could rag on. And just to write one hit song and have like most of the people in the world at one time sing it is a feat of genius. So, you
well,
know,
I haven't gotten there yet. No, I don't know if I will.
No, I understand. But I think it is a really catchy song. And I think you did really kind of capture something there. But what I want to ask you, one of the questions I want to ask you is like, so I mentioned the notion that like, I think this happens to most people. Most people stop growing a lot culturally at 25 or 28 or something like that.
Yeah.
And maybe get preoccupied with other things or, you know, but I want to get at like, do you think right now there are current earworms that are just going to last generations for the current generation? Or, you know, is there been a deterioration in music where, you know, maybe music is designed to be recorded in a session or two and be a hit song for the summer versus someone learning a craft, you know, over a lifetime and then releasing a hit song?
I mean, I think the best songs stand the test of time. There's this podcast called One Hit Thunder, which is composed of a guy from, oh my gosh, what is the name of the band? I can't, whatever. Like, your listeners can go check it out, but they dissect like one hit wonder songs and why it's a hit and kind of where those bands are today. And even if they were just one hit wonders with that one song, like, you know, people are still talking about it, mm-hmm. right? And this goes back decades. And if you kind of ask, to answer your question about modern music today, you still have people in like the legacy mindset of trying to get things viral, whether it's like a record label or, you know, mm-hmm. if a record label kind of like fails. I mean, those people that still understand that industry and marketing and just producers and what a good song sounds like, that's always going to be there. And yeah. So I don't think that's going away. The message might change, but
do you think they're making music that will last as like, you know,
I think I see where you're going.
You know, like where, I mean, like, look, Beethoven and Mozart, not that we might listen to that all day, every day right now, but they spent a whole lifetime to kind of create some of that work, or a Michelangelo with art. And I look even, you know, to some of the bands pre-1971 and even in the 70s where maybe things hadn't impacted them. But then you have so much more free flowing money into that industry. And I think it kind of gets into the industry in two different ways. I think one is more money in the industry going around. It cheapens the time aspect needed to create the art. But then I think also some of the messaging of fiat, whether it's the military industrial complex or some of these overtones get into the music, just like they get into like news or politics or anything. Yeah. Or I'm asking, I wonder what your thoughts are on it.
No, I think that people are definitely influenced by what's going on around them. And like what I did with my song, you know, like with American Idiot or any great song that happens during like whatever like time, place on the time scale they are in life and culture, that's going to come out of them. So that happens. I mean, that happens in really whatever decade you're in.
Yeah.
So the way that fiat influences that is changing in the sense because you don't have all these record labels that have a bunch of money to throw around anymore. And so you have this tail end effect where there is an oversaturation, but the cream is going to rise to the top, and maybe on a global scale, but also in like niche markets, it's kind of like it's a completely like free open market of creativity. And just it really forces people to become more entrepreneurial, because it's really interesting for me to listen to these podcasts about bands talking about like the glory days or whatever. Like, there's another great music podcast I started listening to by Krista Makes. He's the singer from Less Than Jake, or one of the singers, and he kind of does this thing where, you know, being in like the punk rock, ska, or just hardcore, whatever genre, like he's got friends from there and that he toured with, and he has them come on and talk about, you know, like their hit song, and they go through the structure of that. But no one's really on like a big label anymore, and it's really cool, because if you are an artist in a way that you're creating something out of like this devotion and passion that you have, but to not be as reliant and dependent on a record label, you're forcing yourself to really mix your labor with the soil around you and the resources and all that good, like Rothbardian, like Misesian stuff. And it's like the default then is really libertarianism, like being that entrepreneur and becoming your own business. I think it was David Bowie that first said it, like, I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. And I think that's really empowering. And this plays into directly with how technology is disrupting really all industries, but it's kind of forcing everybody to be a sovereign individual, because I think that creatives and musicians are really some of the most primed people for Bitcoin. They should be in Bitcoin because they understand how taken advantage of that they were from the record label and not paying them enough, giving them in advance. And it, like the way that they described it, like on the Mike Carrera podcast, he's the singer bassist for MXPX. He had Ronnie Winter on, who's the singer songwriter of the Red Jumpsuit Apparatus. And they were talking about just the negotiations that they would have with the record label and just getting screwed. And I'm like, guys, this is exactly how the monetary system works. Like, or really probably any just like fiat-fueled corporation, it's, you know, indirectly or maybe directly in bed with the state, but it's just the same like corruption of money. And even under sound money, there's still going to be corruption, but I don't think it's going to be as rampant, because it just really changes things when an individual's money doesn't lose spending power, and all these large institutions do start to crumble, and people do take responsibility in themselves to just be savvy and on their feet. And so that's going to happen in music. That's going to happen really in anything, whether there is that like central bank entity, whether it's a record label or whatever. And I think that more people, artists, whatever, are going to take it upon themselves to act more like sovereign individuals and run their own business. And, yeah, I mean, it, like Bitcoin, if anything, is punk rock, you know, like that's the ethos, like self-reliant, self-sufficient. And it is nice to have that extra support from a label, but you know, you can basically be your own label, you can be your own business. And I think this is going to be applied across the board.
It's so interesting how we can use I think you mentioned it, but like music is a language, just like money's a language.
Yes. It's a universal language. Right. Just to talk on this real quick, that it's so much different to read a book or admire a painting or something like that, because it is quite a global language. I mean, one of the examples that comes on off the top of my head is that I think even still today in Japan, they love rock and roll. Like, this was a big thing in like 70s and 80s, whatever, but it's everywhere, right? I mean, you can listen to anything, and even if it's in a different language, like, hell, I think the Scorpions like sang in English on their first record or whatever, or like they basically didn't know English until like they started touring or whatever. But like, like language aside, everyone can speak the feel goodness of a good song. They can relate to it and they can unite, and music can move people, and they are all speaking the same language message, or they can come to some sort of consensus what that song means to them, even if they come with a different interpretation, because that's one of the beauties of music, is that it can be ambiguous. You can apply it to yourself. However, it still unites people in this like beautiful, like kumbaya way. And they're speaking a similar language. And that is what money, a good sound money, is supposed to do as well. And so I think trying to pair up music, a good song, with money, a good sound money, people can speak the same language. They can relate to it however they want. Again, like the ambiguity of the message, but also people come to Bitcoin for whatever reason, you know. If you're in a first world country, it's a savings vehicle, an investment, it's almost like a privilege. And then people in third world countries where there's rampant inflation or whatever the case, all those different reasons in between, people come to it out of either curiosity or need, necessity. I think it was Alex Svetsky that started saying that first, but that was like my mission, because you need to speak the same language monetarily, or else everyone is just being lied to. And really, Brie Love is the best at explaining that, but it just goes into like the Misesian, like, you know, the broken like price mechanism, and people like, you know, malinvestment into, you know, this sector of the economy or the other, all because of the softness and the manipulation of the money from the central banks. And really, yeah, it's all about just trying to speak the same language. And thankfully, as Bitcoin continues to grow, I think that's like an inevitability. I mean, we're seeing it already with like China, Russia, Iran going against the SWIFT system, because it just doesn't work for them. The dollar as like the reserve currency is an economic weapon. I don't really think that we're going to go into many hot wars anymore. Fingers crossed, knock on wood. But as far as sanctions and just the dependence on, you know, settling oil in dollars, it doesn't work for everyone. But they're coerced into following that standard by the Fed and the IMF. And so people are savvy, like they are naturally going to do what is the most rational thing for their best interest. And that's Bitcoin. Bitcoin's for enemies. Bitcoin is for everyone. And it's going to be a little topsy-turvy maybe in this whole like transition on what it looks like, but for whatever reason, everyone's going to end up on the same playing field on that Bitcoin standard.
Well, I get so excited about this music part. I know what you mean about globally and this global language that everyone understands. 20 years ago, I was backpacking by myself in Fiji, and my most important possession was my iPod at that point. It was the only possession with me that was important. As long as I could take my music with me, I had I was going to be okay. And I ended up in a small little tented village of a couple of families, and we would play the music around the fireplace. And so, you know, this iPod became a tool of worship. And they loved Western music, so they were kind of really familiar with all the music I'd play. But if I went too many songs without playing Bob Marley, you would just hear in the background.
I was literally going to say, he's the first one that came to mind. You can go anywhere in the world and play like every little thing. Yep. It's going to be all right. Fucking the whole catalog. Around the fire.
The whole catalog. And after a little while, if I didn't play, you know, you'd hear Bob Marley. Yeah. You know, and I'd play Bob and everyone would be happy. But it's really interesting also, you know, everyone gets out of that something different, you know, whether it's, and I wonder about with music, where most people, I think, look to get away from things with music. But
yeah,
I was drawn to music that kind of took me towards things, you know, whether it was themes or I would think of them as rabbit holes. I wonder if you've gone, I mean, your shirt is a rabbit hole to me. It's a great Sub Pop. a whole, you know, genre unto itself. And, you know, and there's so many rabbit holes in music. And I, you know, it really is a language. It just, it really blows me away in that regard. And what I'm getting at is, you know, you said earlier, you know, Bitcoin is punk rock. And I think, you know, the language I use is Bitcoin, or the adjective or noun I would use is Bitcoin is hip hop. And, you know, it just in terms of my framework, it's one of my favorite genres. And, but just, it is a lifestyle for a lot of people. And you see it in clothing, music, vernacular. And I think, and I want to ask you, what do you think is the largest genre specific network of music in the world right now?
Ooh, I mean, that ebbs and flows. Like, probably, like I mentioned, tail end. So there's a bunch of genres and everything, but the one that's like, that has dominant appeal is probably hip hop, like right now, because that's just like where we are in the world, or whatever is considered like pop. But you still have,
I'd say pop is real hip, is like hip hop is taking over pop, but I don't really feel there's like a lot of real good hip hop anymore.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you what's like trending or like what the thing is. Like, I can't even tell you right now because I don't think about that often, but who like the biggest artist is. But I think this kind of ebbs and flows with the money, right? I think it was like in the 90s, there was a bunch of just like elasticity of the money. And so that's why like hip hop was a big thing. And you saw it in like the chains or the clothes that rappers were wearing. And then like a decade before that, there was like monetary tightening and people were going to thrift shops. I think I heard American HODL talk about this, but like it makes sense. And that just goes to show what an impact money has on the culture, on society. And it's just funny to think about like what would a sound money standard do for money and culture to begin with. And I think it's we can kind of see it in like the tail end, how there's so much optionality and this abundance that we talk about. But you know, when I said that Bitcoin was punk rock, that was a little like conflicting for me to say, because I think it's rock and roll. And like I remember watching an interview with Johnny Ramone saying that, like, you know, whatever lady was asking him like on the TV was like, you know, what do you call yourself, like punk rock, or is this rock and roll? And he's like, well, rock and roll is like made for punks, you know. And really, any cultural phenomena that people really grasp onto, they do it for escapism, but they also do it for the expression of individuality, and they gain some empowerment. And it's just this beautiful thing that people run to for expression or catharsis or whatever. And I think this plays into like what Marty Bent likes to go off about. I think Beauty On was the first one that started saying this, but how Bitcoin is really just free speech. It's the First Amendment. It's freedom of expression. And it's sure, it's a lot of things. A lot of people like it's money, but it's also a communication protocol to where, you know, it's code, it's math, it's numbers. It's this information that we use to express the value that we have towards things. And it's the most empowering form of expression, like freedom of expression, because it can't be taken away from you. It's a push system, not a pull system. So you have complete power and control over what you spend your of how you express yourself. There's no counterparty risk in that. And I think that music and art in general is the same way, because there's, I mean, yeah, people can have maybe a lack of resources of, you know, like musical equipment or, you know, the right paint brushes or canvases or whatever, but it's really a fair game in how you get those resources to, again, mix your labor with the soil and resources around you to codify, express your beliefs. And back to deflationary technology, that only makes it so much more accessible to everybody.
Yeah. It's interesting how you said before how, you know, your music, I mean, for me, yeah, I think, you know, podcasting replaced a lot of the time I would spend listening to music. It was incredible when we got portable music, how much more time there was for sort of your audio driven information being shared. And then podcasts came along, and I agree. There are still certain segments of my day in life where podcasts won't fill that gap. When I'm, yeah. if I'm working out or running, it's still music for me. And there are just certain moods I get into where a podcast is not going to give me the release that I'm looking for. But I kind of want to, you know, so we've talked about a little bit. We could talk more about your background in music, but then you do get into podcasting. So I'd like to hear a little bit about how you got into podcasting. And, you know, because it is a medium, but it is an audio medium. And it is, I think, where a lot of people who are listening to music a lot more in their day are moving to. So I'm kind of curious how you got into podcasting.
Listening to podcasts. I got into just listening again to seek information. Yeah, I felt like this might sound kind of pathetic, but I felt like I was wronged in my education. And so I was curious and hungry enough to seek out what I thought was truth and just what was going on in the world. And when I was talking about how Dave Smith really was the one that like brought me to where I drive all of my ideological beliefs, I started my own libertarian podcast, which of course turned into a Bitcoin podcast about a year plus later. Cause I was like, you know, the whole libertarian thing is great, but you know, we can start bitching and stop LARPing and actually implement something with Bitcoin. But I like, of course I don't have any regrets doing the whole libertarian thing. Cause, but it's still like what I believe, but now we actually have this tool to implement, what we want to express and live out and carry our lives through. But I started it really to force myself to learn more about it and in history and money. And I think that that's why everybody starts a podcast, is because, or really any, the reason why people start a business, or they want to, they're looking for the solution to a problem and put that out to market. And not that like I have like the biggest podcast in the world, but I really created it to provide this educational vehicle for myself and the solution, or, you know, fill, you know, create the, it was the solution to fill the knowledge gaps that I had.
Right.
And so I've been doing that. I think going on 2 years, I think I officially started it in January, 2019.
Did you go to the Dave Smith podcast for comedy or for libertarianism? Both at that point. And the
libertarianism.
Reason. Okay. So, well, the reason I ask.
Well, you mentioned comedy. It was kind of like a roundabout thing.
Right. Cause I think comedy is another one of those mediums where, you know, you can digest a lot of ideas, obviously. And whether it's subvertly or subtext or directly, again, I like, you know, it's weird to say. It's like, you know, we mentioned, like, I didn't think of my house as political, but every sitcom we watched or every talk show you listen to or every comedian that's presented in the house generally is aligned with politics, whether it's anti-political or left, right, center, whatever it is. It's usually going to be, you know, it's like the nature versus nurture type thing. And so I ask in the regard. So then, you know, it's like you start, I agree with you. Everyone starts a podcast to learn more about a subject. But I would also, and it's a hypothesis of mine that, you know, for a lot of people, it's hard to pick what subject they're going to explore.
Yeah.
And be committed to. And, you know, you can talk to anybody through any lens. You know, libertarianism doesn't narrow you in any regard.
But it's so vast. Just right, like Bitcoin.
But you're
is.
Still picking a topic and that's vast, but it's, you know, so what, and I'm wondering, like, at that point too, it's like you could have done a podcast about music and still used that as a lens to explore.
I did try. That was my first podcast, actually. I disbanded it. But I would go around and interview, like, local musicians in Austin, right, where I live. Because I would go out to shows and, like, I did try to start bands, but it's just hard to, like, gel with the right people, especially if you're not, like, ideologically aligned. But I did go out and do that. Like, I listened to music podcasts, like Lead Singer Syndrome was one of them. So I kind of like did that, but I would like go out in the field and like interview these guys like one-on-one. So that was fun.
That's awesome.
But
wait,
like,
it was called Lead Singer Syndrome?
No. That's another podcast that influenced me.
Oh, I got it.
Yeah. If I said the name, it would possibly dox me. Cause it was before I like chose a NIM. Or pseudonym, but I want to like bring this full circle back to comedy. because like you're so right. And like comedy is just an escape, a relief, because you and I probably agree that we don't have any time for the political correct bullshit. And the person that really codified that for me was Bill Burr. He was one of the biggest like podcasts I really got into. And even I don't listen to him anymore, but you know, Steven Crowder had like that comedic angle because he wanted to start out doing comedy and stuff. And so, and then like Ellen Benjamin's stuff I started listening to, which I really don't anymore, but I really stuck with and occasionally tuned into Dave Smith's because it's not that he's like the most hilarious person on earth, but because he understands the importance of comedy and speaking truth and relating his experiences to other people, it's just the no bullshit presentation of what is on someone's mind and speaking the truth, but also educating people on truth, because he's basically like the stand-up version of all your Mises that you need. And that was also like a big influence on, like, I wasn't trying to like, you know, do an act or anything, but I did want to, like, with my show, just kind of give like a no bullshit, like very chill vibe. Like, this is what I'm going to talk about. This is what I'm going to try to focus on.
Yeah. I find, even whatever you aim for with the show, it doesn't always come out the sausage factory that way. And I think that's the beauty of like taking, you know, your own vision and mapping it, you know, out. One of the things I wanted to ask you is, you know, about today, I think, you know, stand up in general, specifically, and live music, I think is, you know, I wonder how squashed it's going to get with the pandemic, how strong those businesses or that industry will bounce back. Because I do think specifically like stand up comedy is like you were saying, the best medium to speak truth to power. And there are less outlets now.
Yeah.
You know, what's interesting about, like, you know, I thought that video, all forms of video, would get incredibly fractured and fragmentized. And my thinking now is it went through a period where we had a lot of potential for that. Sort of like how we thought the internet would become really decentralized. And it's not. And I see sort of like really video content being not fragmentized at all. There's five or six, I think, huge outlets like Netflix, Disney, Amazon that I think have like become ABC, NBC, CBS. And I think the more we squash, you know, live venues, the less we have that fragmentized opportunity for artists to grow. Whether they reach those levels or not.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I hear Adam Curry talk about this on his podcast, which I didn't get into until last August, but Adam Curry has mentioned things like, you know, just like the control that YouTube has and iTunes, and just it is just a blatant censorship of what people are allowed to say and what they're not. But I think what you were trying to also allude to is that when you take out the live aspect in performance and of just disseminating information and ideas, this is the point I'm trying to make, is that the dissemination of ideas is a threat. You know, it's wrong to think. And in any corporation, you know, arm of the state will try to get a stranglehold on that. And he talked about some like New York Times article or something from NPR, I can't remember, but how, like, in the article, it blatantly said, like, you know, this internet thing's dangerous because people go down these rabbit holes and they turn into alt-right freaks and this and that. And it's just fear-mongering of people are using the internet for bad things and they're thinking for themselves and they're finding ideas that are counter to the narrative. So that's happening at the, like, at the cyberspace level. But, man, if it takes them a pandemic to sweep out everything on like the ground, like in meat space, where people go to these clubs like freely and willingly, and you know, to get the good comedy or music or like the truth, because these are real people in real time, real life, sharing these ideas. But if it takes a goddamn pandemic to wipe that out and control the freedom of thought, then how is that not evil? You know, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but right. I think that is a pretty sound conclusion that you can come to, because I mean, like, of course, this economic stranglehold that this pandemic has really, you know, gotten hold on by taking out like middle class and these businesses, it is also in a way hindering people from spreading these ideas from peer to peer. But I think, as you see with history, people fight back, they snap back, they turn around. They're humans are savvy, humans are natural problem solvers and entrepreneurs. And you know, like the failure of BitGold or all these other, you know, cryptocurrency attempts at digital cash, like that didn't stop Bitcoin from being created, and prohibition didn't stop people from drinking alcohol or the war on drugs. And so really this goes back to people coming to Bitcoin out of curiosity or pain or necessity. Like, necessity is the main driver of innovation. And, you know, I don't want to say that we need these natural disasters or just these mishaps that affects the entire earth, but free markets are inevitable, and price signals and just signals to humanity is inevitable. And I think it is going to take those catastrophic events to really wake people up and come up with solutions to, you know, whatever the case may be. But in this case, it's people are going to human. They're going to find a way to do what they want. And I think a great example, you're probably familiar with it. Maybe you have a tribe yourself, but Sphinx, like what they're doing, you know, everything in Bitcoin is in beta, but it's still empowering to see that even though it like may not be, you know, 100%, this thing works. Like, it's a decentralized, like spam free version of Telegram that you can like pay sats to join a group and pay sats to send a message, and you can stream the content creators money, and it's entirely in the control of the creator. And so I think that it is a direct response to what these central planners are trying to do at a global scale, because you can't fight back innovation. It's like the Ouroboros snake, and that's the same thing that fiat does to deflationary technology. The more money they print, the more they exacerbate the problem that they're trying to fight. Is that, yeah, some of that money is going to go into zombie companies like WeWork or whatever, and you know, startups that just flop, but it's also going to birth the Ubers and, you know, whatever else comes out. And so only under a sound money standard, I think, you know, we'll have solutions that will, you know, save the world. But that's in the future, and we're here now. And it is a really exciting thing to watch this stuff happen in real time and try to learn more about it and be a part of it as much as you can.
Yeah. I think podcasts have filled the space that, you know, live comedy has kind of lost out to, just in terms of ideas being shared, spontaneous, you know, recorded conversation, but spontaneous live chat between individuals. And right now, I would say it's somewhat free. I do think we're already censored on the internet, especially in terms of self-censorship. And I think that it's things like Sphinx Chat and related technologies really are only our greatest hope. And what gives me the greatest optimism for the future is sort of that decentralized internet. Or internet-related or like technologies. I'm just not sure how much the rest of the world wants these things. We talked a lot about wants.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the rest of the world cares that much.
And they don't. That's the sad thing.
But I think what the beauty of your mission is, we can get through to them through things like music and culture and clothing and ethos, any way that culture expresses itself. So, I think that's the way it is. It's like, yeah, when you're in high school and you like this kind of band or that kind of music, you do wear clothing, or any time in your life, you know, whatever it is, your team, your whatever it is that you might have an affinity for. It could even be a t-shirt you got at a family picnic. You know, you're going to express yourself in some way, like, oh, he was there or she was there, or, you know, or they might think that shirt's ironic and I'm an ironic person, you know?
Yeah.
So I you know, yet in the same way, you know, if gold was the soundest money on earth, I don't think I would go where I'm not a jewelry person. I'm not going to get a gold. You know, you know, if someone offered me 12% in, you know, savings on my checking account, savings account, I wouldn't wear the t-shirt. Yet I think Bitcoin kind of transcends the way, in the way that music would transcend, like, you know, wearing cash on your shirt if the dollar was really sound. You know, so I do yearn for the day when there's more sound money in our culture, you know, whether it's through clothing or music.
Yeah, it's really hard to, I mean, we can play pretend on what the future is going to hold, but also it's like, as humans, you know, we kind of become our own central planners when trying to do that. Like, we're not really supposed to know how it's supposed to work out, but we do know that what's working now is not working.
Mm. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I want to hear a little bit more about your journey into the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And how you came up with the Sue pseudonym.
Oh, okay. So before A Boy Named Sue, the current name of my podcast, it was the Pseudolectual Podcast, which was confusing people because they always called it the Pseudo Intellectual Podcast. It was called the Pseudolectual, and then they started adding the intellectual, and I'm like, no, dude, you're saying it wrong. In fact, like, some Asian chick had a podcast called the Pseudo Intellectual, so I was like, okay, I'll just, you know, drop that. And so that's where Sue came from, because it was just short. And then because I have an attachment to music, I took the title of the Johnny Cash song and just added, you know, PSEU instead of SUE. So just try to have a little fun with that. So my Bitcoin journey, I guess, started like in the spring of 2019, because I had already like heard about crypto and stuff, and it was just intimidating to me at first. Like, I feel it is to a lot of people, especially in the libertarian space, because they're more, in a way, like intellectual or like very, very studious in maybe more of an old school fashion. Like, it's funny, like Vijay Boyapati talks about how Rothbard was like a Luddite, you know, like he would type stuff on a typewriter, but like just like very, very studious and not as, I guess, cypherpunk as I'd like, or as maybe some people like, I don't know, who am I to judge? But, you know, it wasn't until later I learned about the cypherpunks and like high-tech Hayekians and stuff like that. But needless to say, the whole like tech thing kind of intimidated me, like how the blockchain works and all this crap. And so I kind of put it to the side for a while, because I thought like, oh, I'm too dumb to get this. And then when the whole Libra thing in 2019 happened, and I was listening to other like libertarian podcasts, the information I was consuming kind of made me think, oh, well, is this a threat if, like, you know, Facebook and, you know, how entrenched they are, and like going to the Atlantic Council where, you know, they talk about, you know, decisions to make on a technological basis that will impact the globe, or like whatever the hell they talk about. I just thought that, you know, if they got a hold of this like crypto thing, like they'll, you know, take over the world and like control money and everything. And I thought that Bitcoin and crypto, well, man, I feel so gross saying that word crypto.
Yeah, me
like
too.
Shitcoinery has really just bastardized that term. But like, I thought it was so empowering that I was hearing like altcoiners talking about how they like spend their B cash for anything in the world off like a like they preload a debit card like with BitPay, and they can have all these this crypto, and it sells in fiat, of course, but like they're in control of their money and they don't like pay taxes or like whatever. And I thought, oh, that's cool, but then like, you know, that won't work if like Facebook is in charge of it. Just not understanding how, like, you know, what a blockchain is and why there's only one blockchain that matters on a truly decentralized like manner and not really understanding the importance of decentralization or like what it was. And so, you know, hearing all this like Libra talk and just, you know, Trump talking about it and it getting the attention in that summer where it shoots up to like 10K, people freak out and it's in the press and whatnot. I'm like, okay, I need to learn about this. Like this crypto thing sounds like freedom money and I don't want that to be ruined by a corporation. So I was listening to Vin Armani on the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast, which is still a great podcast. I had the host, Pete Quinones, on my show a couple of times. Really sweet dude. He's at the Libertarian Institute now. He has been for over a year with Scott Horton. And I did do like a little internship like thing over there helping out post blogs and whatever. So his podcast and Scott Horton's show, of course, were really influential on my thought of like liberty and freedom. So Pete had Vin Armani on, which he's a pretty cool dude. Like, you know, shit coining aside, I like where his head's at. He means well, but evidently if you watch his debate that he had with Guy Swan, he doesn't know what the fuck a hard fork is. And he's a developer. So not to put words in his mouth, but go look at that clip that I told Ben of the BTC sessions, like in the Telegram group. Like I timestamped that that point in the interview where guys like this literally what a hard fork is, and like the just dumbfoundedness on Vin's face is hilarious. And so like I shared those timestamps and Ben just like made this awesome like meme clip of it. But anyway, I had Vin on my show a couple times and that piqued my curiosity and he encouraged me to like, you know, go find a meetup if you want to get involved in the space. I'm like, yeah, dude, that's awesome. So I started going to a Bitcoin meetup that was not Bitcoin only, but it was a good experience. I had to wade my way through the whole like shit corneriness. It was held by Paul Snow, who was like the CEO of Factum, that token. I think that token is no longer in existence, but I don't know. And I was just like weeding my way through. I also had Sal the Agorist on my show, Sally Mayweather. And really what made me think that Bitcoin is the one and only thing was getting over the Bcash narrative that they were calling the Bitcoin Core, the BTC maximalist status, because they won't have a free market of money in competition. And so that's why the Bitcoin Cash team were real like libertarian people like fighting against the man and were like the modern day American revolutionaries. And I just thought that sounds cool and awesome. And like they have fast, cheap transactions. Great. And Sal wrote an article on his blog called The Economics of Bitcoin Maximalism, where he compared Bitcoin Cash to Bitcoin, and that Bitcoin Cash is apparently more saleable than Bitcoin because of fast, cheap transactions. And he just misconstrued stuff that Manger said. And it really didn't... It took me to listening to Guy Swan's show because I was listening to another podcast that was very inspirational to me to start my podcast called The Friends Against Government Podcast, which is now called Timeline Earth. But, you know, they're friends with Pete as well and a bunch of like the libertarian and ANCAPs on Twitter and all this stuff. But I was listening to them because, one, they were funny as hell. Like the whole comedy thing with Dave Smith and all that, they were really funny. Like I aspired my podcast to be somewhat like that, which I failed in, but nothing can really replace the magic that they do. But they had Guy Swan on, and they at the time had two main co-hosts, Car Campit and Bird Archist, whatever he goes by. But Car is actually a fellow Texan and he's a big like Bitcoin maximalist, if you want to call it, but you know, and so you know, he really loved Guy's show and they jived and all the stuff. And I wasn't a Bitcoin maximalist at the time, and I kind of pushed myself and challenged myself to listen to what Guy was saying. And I'm like, wow, this guy actually sounds like he's making sound arguments. And what's funny is that one of his listeners told Guy to read Sal Mayweather's critique on the Bitcoin Cash versus Bitcoin Core article, which is funny because in that article that he writes, Sal writes, I was on a Boy Named Sue podcast to talk about this. And he links my like show podcast, like, you know, in the article, and Guy like reads that because he reads the whole damn article. So I'm like, it like, okay. So hearing Guy Swan on the Friends Against Government or Fadcast, and then being like, okay, I should listen to this. And then it was like the latest episode was him reading Sal's article. And I'm like, oh shit, this can't, really? The one that he talked about like on my show? And then, you know, just immediate attention grabber where like I get like a quick name drop. And then I listen to him read the article and his critique, and it just hit me like, oh my gosh, like everything I've learned about crypto is a lie. Like the problem is money, and this is why. And I still didn't completely understand it, but again, it was like challenging myself and following my curiosity to really grok Bitcoin and understand what it was. And so I guess we fast forward to late October, November 2019 is I wanted to buy a VPN so I could buy some shit coins, diversify my portfolio for when a fiat apocalypse comes, because there's this dude named Donnie Gebert, he was on Pete's show, that wrote like pretty amusing book called A Direct Republic, and basically using like a blockchain or something to like vote, again, good ideas, but you know, it's just like people in the libertarian space like not understanding Bitcoin and why only one money works. But he was talking about the like a fiat apocalypse and hedging yourself, because this is again the time that like we quote unquote like lost Hong Kong and things in like the markets were just going haywire, kind of like the foreshadowing of things to come for my screen froze. Like the things to come before COVID. So like in the background, like the repo market and, you know, shit's going haywire, where the cracks in the system are starting to show and the Fed's trying to subdue all of that. But, you know, all that fear and whatnot made me think it sounded like a good idea to hedge and diversify myself in like all these crypto assets because the dollar is going to collapse or whatever. So I'm like, okay, so, you know, Donnie told me to go on Binance, but I can't buy from there because I'm a US citizen. So let's hide my IP address with the VPN. So I went to Nord, and this is like my first time experience with Bitcoin. I couldn't use my debit or credit card to buy the VPN because it was a VPN. It was like a no-no taboo thing that my credit union wouldn't let me buy. And I was on the phone for 20 minutes on hold waiting for them to look into it. And I'm like, you know, it's probably because I'm buying a VPN and they don't like that. And lo and behold, the lady comes back and she's like, oh yeah, you're going to have to call your branch. And I'm just like, fuck this. Like, no, like money is supposed to work. It's my money, right? Well, no, because later after reading Creature from Jekyll Island, like, you know, it's an IOU and fractional reserve banking, and it's not really your money because it's being lent out and all this bullshit, but I hadn't gotten there quite yet. But I'm like, well, this sucks. I was going to have to buy Bitcoin anyway to buy all these shit coins. So went to Cash App, bought 100 whatever dollars worth of Bitcoin to buy my VPN. And it worked. I was like astonished. And it was the most empowering feeling I had ever felt in my life, knowing that I used my money truly in my possession to buy something I wanted permissionlessly because I wanted to protect my privacy. And my bank that I've been a loyal customer to won't let me do that. Like I've got like a 790 something credit score and they're like, no, you can't do this. No, thanks. I'm going to take my business elsewhere. And yeah, like Bitcoin works. like it works for everybody for anything, not anything, of course, but if you, it's there for you to spend when you need it, and it's there as a savings vehicle all the time. And it's really the best hedge that anybody can ask for. Like this is one of the reasons why people say Bitcoin is hope, because it's just there for you. And that was the real nail in the coffin. And the more I listened to Guy's show, and the more I, you know, got into the Bitcoin Standard, and just the more podcasts I consumed and the friends I made on Twitter and in Telegram, the stronger my conviction was. And ever since like that fall of 2019, I went straight from being a libertarian podcast to Bitcoin, because Bitcoin does provide that tool for you to stop bitching and start acting and implement and to be a part of this change and this revolution. And I haven't looked back ever since.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I think about this a lot, where I try to recreate or try to figure out what the key to the puzzle is to onboard people from an educational standpoint, from a conceptual or theoretical standpoint, not just here, I'm going to shill this thing, number go up. So how do you get conviction? How do you educate people? And it seems like there's two ways Bitcoiners are made. It's one is through education, but two, through having a problem that they solve. And that's a harder one to replicate.
Yeah.
Because not everyone wants to buy a VPN or something that Bitcoin might
drugs buy. On the Silk Road, whatever, but like.
Sure, but most people in the first world can get those things on the black market with cash.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can make the argument that Silk Road actually improved that market and made it safer. It didn't necessarily, I don't know if it really increased access. Maybe for some, in terms of, you know, like Peter McCormack's mother's story, you know, that was an access one. But for most people, I think it was just getting better stuff and more secure in a weird way.
And to that point, like, just to add on that little like tangent, like that's one of the reasons Ross created the Silk Road and designed it the way it was designed. Like he wanted to weed out bad actors and wanted like more sophisticated, savvy people of how to leverage Tor and Bitcoin and, you know, just filter it out to the highest quality of people to deliver the highest quality of results and just let the free market do its thing. So yeah, I totally agree. That's probably the reason I didn't like get into it like in high school, because I really, up until this past year, I was not technologically inclined or savvy. Like the whole learn to code thing just felt like a slap in my face, because I was never good at math. And it wasn't until I found Bitcoin where I started asking myself, how the does a computer work? What the hell is the internet? Like, why is this such a big thing? And it really just goes back to how curious are you and what is your position? And just like meeting people halfway there. But I've become so content and complacent now, and I'm not going to force anyone to a Bitcoiner.
No force. It's opt-in, no force. But
I'm not going to convince everyone.
Well, yeah. But how would you get through, or how do you think you would get through to yourself, or even more broadly, someone like yourself a year earlier? And what I mean by that is not via here's 10 podcasts, here's 10, like here's what would be like, and maybe there is none, but would you give your prior self one article, even if it wasn't the one that you came across then, but like, what do you think what would crystallize it for you? Do you think earlier, or help someone else? Do you think there's that material out there that could help someone, get on the road faster, even if it's not one and done? But what would you give to your prior self, the first thing, if you could get to yourself earlier?
Vijay Boyapati is the bullish case for Bitcoin.
Right.
And it would have been hard. I couldn't have recommended that. Even though I haven't like been in Bitcoin for like 2 years, like it'll be 2 years in, I guess, October and November of this year. But, you know, I was also very fortunate to have this abundance of information, of podcasts, of books, of whatever. And I hear people talk about when they were early into this, they didn't have that privilege and they really had to like seek out and look for it, or they had to be like tech savvy and hear about peer-to-peer networks or whatever. And, you know, luckily we do have all these great resources, and like the abundance just keeps coming. So yeah, I think VJ's article came out in 2018, right? I think. Sounds so good. it wouldn't have been that far.
Well, it's a make-believe game.
I found Bitcoin.
It's a make-believe game. You could give it to yourself in like Back to the Future. You could give this article to yourself if it existed in this make-believe world. Because it's for people today. I'm wondering, you know, I was just basically asking, what would you give someone today who was like you or similar to you or anybody really? What do you think really gets through? I'm kind of curious, you know, listening to you on Clubhouse really kind of broadened, because, you know, hearing you on your pod, you don't get to hear as much of you as much as you asking questions and other people responding. And I was just really impressed with your, I don't know if you want to call it aura, but your ability to kind of just be in the moment and be very comfortable in that medium. And then I see that the more I've listened to your pod, the more I understand that now. And so it seems to me, I think you would have just been really great at podcasting about anything. And I think that's what makes your show interesting and not limited. And I'm just trying to dig out like about the libertarianism thing and the Bitcoin thing. And in that regard, I'd love to hear more about Texas. And I think you're in Austin now. I'm not trying to dox you, but.
No, it's all good.
Are you from
Austin? I'm technically in Round Rock, but yeah, it's the greater Austin area.
Sure. Are you from, but you're from Texas, maybe not from Austin?
Hold on one sec. I need a born and raised Texan. I moved here when I was 7 from Spokane, Washington, but I went to junior high and in high school where work was. And so that's, So I was like a Texas transplant from
Spokane, Washington. Do you feel like one? I mean, 7's kind of young. I definitely moved. I moved at 8, turning 9. I definitely remember the before and after. So maybe you do.
Yeah.
And was that quite a change? And because you see,
at the time, because like,
I didn't mean to cut
you. Go ahead.
Well, I just mean it was quite a change, and you know, because it. Everything I've heard, I didn't know you were from Washington, and you sound very proud to be a Texan or in Austin or both. So I didn't know you were from Washington. And was it a big contrast? And are you now a native Texan? Yeah. Have you spent a lot of time outside of Texas?
No, like 100%. I feel like a Texan. I really do. Like the accent might not come across, but I say y'all, but just because it's fucking easier to say. But like it, as far as like the impacts, like, you know, I was it was probably a little bit of a shock, of course. Like I remember having like, you know, crying episodes like in like my new school, and you know, just like oversensitive kind of stuff, because you know, when your parents split and you move across the country at that young, you know, it's a change. But you grow and you learn and you get over it. And I still visit Washington from time to time, like in the summers, and it's a nice area.
Yeah.
Like I go to the Seattle area,
yeah,
where I've got family. So it's cool. But you know, as far as Texas, I feel like a Texan. I really do.
Two huge music cities.
Yeah.
Austin, that is, and Seattle.
Yeah, like the history is there for sure. I don't really know what it
is. Is that important
as
to
far
you?
As like
in terms of living in Austin right now, or prior maybe, but just in general, is that a big part of why you're in Austin? The live music or the music scene?
Yeah, like when I first moved here, that's a thing I tried to do is, you know, find people and start a band, and I would go see local shows. But again, it was just like me just being too picky and like not really I guess gelling well with the musicians, or just feeling like it wasn't really a part of that crowd, you know. I didn't have like any falling outs, but it's just like I was so emotionally removed from where they were. And it's just, it's easier these days, but it's also hard to just find the right musicians to like kind of stick it through with. But
is Bitcoin a big part of why it was hard to maybe not connect with them? Like maybe because they weren't getting what you were going through and learning about? I'm just asking because I could see that.
Well, I wasn't, when I was trying to like me, people, I wasn't into Bitcoin, but I don't think I even called myself a libertarian at that point. Like the libertarian thing wasn't until like I moved at the beginning of 2017, and it took about almost a year to like get the libertarian light bulb to really go off. But just knowing that, you know, a lot of them don't know better, but they start off as like socialists pretty much, just because that's like the artsy like music scene. But like Texas is really important to like the music histories there, whatever, but it's really becoming a Bitcoin capital, that and arguably Miami, because you know their mayor is actually like doing shit with it. But yeah, you know, I don't think that'll matter, because we'll start to see jurisdictional arbitrage, hopefully. But Texas is becoming like an awesome hub. I go to the BitDev meetup at Unchained Capital. I've been going like every month for the past year, or during COVID, like when they shut down for a while, I went back immediately and met a lot of great people there. And every meetup gets increasingly bigger, and people moving from New York and all over the country to Austin as Bitcoiners, and you know, finding, you know, cheaper real estate in comparison to California or New York or and all that jazz. And so, you know, I'm very fortunate to build the what relationships and friendships I have here. It's I just feel really blessed to have found Bitcoin to begin with, and it just to be in Texas out of happen chance. And I say happen chance, but I'm not, Bitcoin's making me become more spiritual. And I don't think things just happen for a reason. I think there is a greater power out there. And Breedlove talks about basically in towards the end of Masters and Slaves of Money, how Bitcoin is kind of like this manifestation of like God or God's gift to man. To, you know, try to fix society in a way. And, you know, people say that jokingly God works in mysterious ways, but I think he or whatever, you know, I think there's some greater cosmic entity out there that works through people, through innovation, because entrepreneurship and free markets and people just surviving, I think, is the default of society. And Bitcoin has really become the manifestation of that. And is another reason why Bitcoin is hope, because it is working and people are coming to it. And, you know, just that Bitcoin didn't just happen randomly. You know, it was an iterative process over decades and working through some of the greatest minds that have walked this earth. And for it to just be almost a response after the great financial crisis of 08, I just think that's really beautiful and romantic. And it just it was something that was birthed in a response to just the manipulation of the financial system. And you know, that's something that I don't think is a random occurrence. I think God or whatever you believe in works in mysterious ways and through people to, you know, give us what we need. And sure, we can ask like, yeah, you know, why have there been genocides and war and terrorist attacks? You know, if there is like some God spaghetti monster in the sky, why is he, you know, bestowing all this pain on us? And this kind of goes into free markets work because they're not utopias. You need the Talebian wildfire to burn away the brush. You need those market corrections to make those corporations fail and properly reallocate capital to those who are responsible and know how to run successful businesses. And not that like God or whatever you believe in is treating us like ants and he's the kid with the magnifying glass. But, you know, I think the world is just naturally like supposed to be this hands-off approach where people just go through ebbs and flows of pain and prosperity. And even though that there might be a global stranglehold through governments or central banks or whatever, as coercive and powerful that they may be over individuals, and as sticky as the state is to people's freedom, that and as much as free markets are prevented, I think that's coming to a close, because the fiat experiment is failing. So we may not think that we live in free markets, but we do, like, markets do provide are do persist. And even if we don't live in free markets, where things that we want to fail don't fail, I think it just they get their the proverbial can gets kicked down the road to where it really fails in their face. But because Bitcoin is here, I think hopefully that's the tool that we can use to just have a easier transition and not like a complete like all out war.
I believe there's no transition without Bitcoin. It's one of the few things that gives me hope economically and in the macro sense. The cynic in me thinks things will get more restricted and more painful for everyone in terms of the masses before Bitcoin emerges for the masses. I don't know how that works.
I don't either. I agree to that to some extent, maybe more than I'd like to say. But
yeah, but on that note, you know, it's like, I wonder if Bitcoin gives you Zen. To me, you seem very calm and peaceful day to day. What I'm getting at is you engage in a way that I think is very present and very understanding and very sort of not so demanding. You know,
some days are way easier than others, man.
So what I want to get to there, fine, you know, because maybe I'm only seeing you in your best on Clubhouse or something. So, but you know, one of the things you mentioned is that growing up, you know, music can make every day a holiday. And you know,
so can,
considering the weight of what we talked about, does music make every day a holiday still? Are you know, do you spend a lot of time ruminating on some of these darker thoughts? Are you more in just in the moment, or are you ruminating more in some of the maybe the holiday type thoughts that music might give?
Both. It's all about a balance. I was definitely facing some of those darker thoughts when I wrote that song. Because it's dark stuff. It's dark stuff when you read.
So happy the song, though, like chipper in a way.
I know, because it had to be that light at the end of the tunnel. You know, I can't really pinpoint a specific song that does this, but there's a lot of artists that, well, maybe Bayside would be a good example, but just people having like these dark undertones lyrically in a song, but it's like one of the happiest things you've ever heard. But like, I wrote that song like as a relief for people, because music is still my relief. And you know, people, I think dark stuff all the time. Like, I have the same anxieties, not the same, but I have anxiety. I think about you know, the future and trying to prepare myself and you know, trying to be the best and to try to not make mistakes. Like, I'm human like everyone else is, and because I'm human, I think humans are naturally prone to fix themselves, to relieve themselves from pain. And I guess you can hear that in the music, like me trying to string all these ideas together, like the Federal Reserve and you know, sound money and free and open source software, and you know, our one and only hope is this Bitcoin thing. You can kind of hear, I hope you can hear the human elements of me working out these questions and packaging it in like an optimistic, fun, you know, presentation. But yeah, I was very much in the moment. It was actually a stressful situation because the music was all there for the most part, but I kept it like, God bless Abram Olvay. He's the guy that engineered and helped produce the song with me. The music that you hear in my podcast is actually me playing, but he did drums on that. And that's actually a full song that I have, but I haven't like.
You mean the interlude?
The intro and the outro. That's actually a full song.
But you also have the interlude where I think, you know, the three things, subscribe, review, rate. Yeah, I like that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was just me playing guitar and singing into like my USB microphone. But he actually produced and engineered the intro and outro song, which is like a full song that I haven't like publicly released. But going back to writing the song, it was actually a little stressful. Like I was very like in the moment, but I was kicking my own ass and being a pain in Abram's ass because I was being so hard on myself because I was writing the lyrics like session by session. I would come with a little bit more lyrics because I was trying to piece together how it should go and making it not so wordy, and just being mad and hard on myself like physically in his presence. And it was just the negativity I brought and being hard on myself was just like not coming off. And you know, I was kind of a bastard to work with. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was just putting a lot of passion into it. And I've heard musicians talk about this where they had to have, you know, their bandmates or producers say just like, hey man, let it go. Like the engineer knows what he's doing and he's just going to piece this all together for you. Like you can trust him. And as much as I want to have control over it, kind of like with life as well, you just have to like let some things go. And I guess this might go back to having like the dark thoughts of, you know, the corruption of the state or whatever. It's it could bring you back to Bitcoin to just like let it go, because like thank God we have this thing. But yeah, it was a fun process, like writing the song. What was the question?
What do you think your mindset would be without Bitcoin if there was no Bitcoin in existence right now? No digital hard money.
I'd be depressed.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard a lot of people say that. What's the name? It'll come to me. Kyle something. I don't know. I can't remember. I had him on the show. Man, I feel like a jerk not knowing his name. But like he's written some blogs about like cryptography and like cypherpunk stuff. And when he shares his story, he talks about how he kind of came from this radical leftist like socialist kind of thing, and him being on Wall Street during Occupy Wall Street. And you know, people are upset and passionate about these issues, and yeah, you can blame Wall Street and the banks, but you know, he would say verbally, like without Bitcoin, he probably would have been in a really dark place, and Bitcoin saved him. Like it gives people peace of mind. So I don't think I would have gone crazy, because like libertarianism first kind of saved me, and so it was just like a natural easy path to, you know, understanding sound money, because I was already kind of primed for it. So I feel thankful that I was able to find, you know, all my Ron Paul and Rothbard and Mises first.
Let's say I'm kind of curious, where would you want to be in 20 or 30 or 40 years? Mind you, you know, let's say Bitcoin is now sound money. You got three hit records under your belt, you know, in the sound money music revolution. So, you know, you could, you know, obviously make more music, but you've done that already. What would you be doing day to day in 30 years?
I mean, probably making more music, but.
Well, okay, then would you be? What would you be doing? Like, would you want to be doing live music somewhere? Would you know, you've done it all, or you can do whatever you want. What would the day look like? You know, would that mean a concert every night on the road? You know, would you set up camp in Austin and there would just be a huge show every night? Like, what would you be doing in your free time?
I'm a really bad like musician to the point where I would not want to go on the road. Like, I feel like a poser and like a fraud for not playing like a lot of live shows. Like, I know the experience of like being on stage, because I had like a crappy high school band where we did covers, but like, I could be like high maintenance and like me just like kind of wanting to like control my day to day and like the uncertainty. I guess that makes me fragile in this like Bitcoin anti-fragile mindset. But it would be cool to travel, see the world. You know, if we were on a Bitcoin standard, I'd have like a nice RV with like a gym inside it. I don't know. I'm just kidding. But like it is good for people to like go out and travel. So maybe I would be touring. But you know, maybe I'd also like be live streaming sets. But before I do any of that, I need to find like a band of Bitcoiners, because like all of that is me on the song, other than like the drums. Those are programmed, but you know, I programmed like the snare and the kick and the toms and the cymbals and all that, because it's still like my vision. But you know, if we're on a Bitcoin standard, hopefully a lot of people, you know, think similarly. So yeah, it'd be great to like have a band. But you know, the music thing aside, I guess, you know, having my own place and being involved in Bitcoin companies and projects, solving problems, whether, you know, it would be stuff with I don't know, you name it, like an app, working on the UX and UI of Bitcoin, you know, having more time to learn about development. I've recently learned more about like network engineering and learning the command line and learning about like bash and scripts. And again, all because of Bitcoin, like questioning my curiosity of technology. So maybe just, you know, working for Bitcoin companies, actually building out this infrastructure that we need to make Bitcoin work for the rest of the world, or maybe being involved in like mining companies or something. You know, if you're actually doing work for Bitcoin, it's more rewarding. It's not like having a fiat, like corporatized, like bureaucratic, you know, job where you're just a cog in the machine. I mean, I think some of that's always going to be in like a company. Like you're always going to have some office politics, but I think it becomes more manageable and healthier if you're on a Bitcoin standard and everyone kind of is on the same page and is there for the mission and the incentives just properly align, because the money isn't broken. So a lot of people are going to have much more time to themselves to express themselves and learn more about themselves and explore themselves, because deflationary money will hold its value and people will have like a 4-hour work week and all this kind of stuff. You know, maybe this is just utopian BS, but I don't really think that's the case. It feels like that now, but yeah. So that's if things don't go south. Marty Ben talks about, you know, fighting against the panopticon. Mm. So if we are on a Bitcoin standard, I guess that won't be a thing. That's kind of like the intermittent battle between where we are now and then. But again, it's kind of foolish for us to think about what the world's gonna look like on a Bitcoin standard, because again, we're humans. We shouldn't try to centrally plan this stuff out. You know, we'll get to a better future one step at a time, one company, one solution, one product, one innovation, one handshake, one relationship, one family at a time. And we just have to roll with the punches and be strong. And Bitcoin, believing in Bitcoin, finding Bitcoin is really going to be the safe haven, the rock. Like sound money, sound mind, like the avenue for us to get to that better place.
Yeah, I definitely hear all that. Is there anything, you know, I like to think that every year of my life gets better, that every year of life just gets better. I know that's not always the case for everyone and not always the case maybe for myself even, but I strive for that and I've been lucky. But like, do you think, you know, are there any silver linings to this past year or anything that you're super optimistic about, even if it's irrelevant to the past year, that you just see out there, you know, in meat space, real life markers? Is there anything you're excited about? Maybe outside of Bitcoin without using that generality of just Bitcoin?
Yeah, that's hard since Bitcoin kind of consumes my life. And I think that... I mean, people just waking up and starting to question the system, I guess. Whatever way you voted, or like this past election, or just whatever rules that you were trying to follow with everything that came from last year, it just people, I think, are becoming more savvy that the system's starting to break. Like, I know that sounds like stupid. I don't want to like speak for anyone, but I feel like people are, in a way, becoming more self-aware and self-reliant, and just are going to start questioning how things really work, or at least question how to better their lives. And man, this is kind of, it's kind of a BS answer. I don't really know where to go from here.
Sure.
To be honest, it's like, I don't know. Can you say the question again? Like, any silver linings? Like, technology is definitely a silver lining.
Or just what makes you optimistic right now? You know, besides just the carte blanche Bitcoin, like, is there anything that, like, and it can be something in Bitcoin, maybe it's Start 9 or Sphinx Chat, you know, but like, what has you really, is there anything really jazzed that has you really jazzed, or that you are, you know, did you maybe see somebody get orange pilled lately? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know,
I think, I mean, people are voting with their feet, maybe in places like Austin. And is Austin
changing?
I mean, because just that, in
from the my big of people,
I think I'd hope. It's funny, the last bit that I was at Parker Lewis was like, if you live in Austin, or if you're planning on moving to Austin, please vote. I can't remember if it's for Proppy or against Proppy, but it was basically voting in favor of getting rid of like the homeless people tents under the bridge, because we don't want to become a San Francisco. And I think it was overwhelmingly like a majority vote to get rid of the tents. It was like 57-42% or something. And just people really standing up for truth in that, because a lot of people have lost their businesses and are feeling hopeless, and but at the same time are willing to wake up and fight back and use their voice. And I don't know, I would love to see the 50 states become 50 countries, and just people acting more locally. There was a good example. I don't really think it was like pandemic related or something, but it was nice to see that voting, like local politics, works. Because my friend, my little brother was riding bikes with his friends, and there was like this old rich lady who just complained at the city level. And just seeing like all the families of the kids like come together and like speak up for the kids that, you know, they weren't really doing anything wrong, or people like acting and voting locally for just better governance, whether it be like bread or infrastructure, like people taking the power into their own hands, I think is like in every aspect of their life is going to be emphasized with Bitcoin. So I don't know what kind of example Florida is going to be setting, but I think I've heard rumors about like the government putting them on like a Bitcoin standard or something, or accepting payment and taxes in it or whatever. I don't know if they've like put it on like their treasury balance, but I don't know. I think we're going to see more sovereign individuals, frankly. I don't really know how it happens, but I think a lot of people after this year have felt cheated because they lost their businesses, and they are just savvy, resourceful humans that are going to work together and just create solutions that they need to get to the next step. And I think that's just going to kind of like light the fire of localism and community in the least communist sounding way I can make it sound.
Yeah, man. I'm going to read you back to you from your article. Times are weird, really weird. People are distracted and either unaware of the questions that need to be asked or simply afraid to ask them in the first place. To be super cheesy and quote Bob Dylan, the times, they are changing. Indeed, a change is coming. Phil, for one, would like to be on Bitcoin's side of that change. Bitcoin may fix this, but a change in culture must happen first. And the best way to change the culture is by entertainment. So Phil's goal is to write the anthemic record, the soundtrack filled with earworms of the sound money revolution. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation. I'll definitely leave it to you for any parting words and let people know where they can find you, the music video, and your pod.
Yeah. Wow. Just hearing that back, it's kind of like, I can't believe I wrote those words. You know, I feel like I needed to hear them again, frankly. And it was kind of funny. I kind of wrote that up in a rush because I wanted to share the song on that. But, you know, they were, you know, pushing me to like write something. And yeah, I mean, that is like one way to go about it is just use the culture to unite people. But yeah, I hope people did enjoy the article if they read it. If you haven't, checked it out in issue 6 of Citadel 21. Please go check out the music video. I made that with Richard James, who wrote who made the sound the Hard Money film, hardmoneyfilm.com. That's a great documentary if you haven't checked it out. He also did one on Enemy of the State by Rothbard, but it was a pleasure working with him. And Big Hill Yanowski, who does all the great Bitcoin artwork for Blue Wallet, Citadel 21, and many others, BitBlock Boom. He did the artwork on the cover of the single ETF. So ETF is on any music streaming platform. It's in all caps, ETF, and there's a period after each letter. And the artist is me, Mr. Sue, MRPSEU. My podcast is A Boy Named Sue, where I drop an episode every Monday, just interviewing great people like Cedric and other people in the space. And yeah, if you do want to support me with sats, you know, feel free to do so. I jokingly wrote on the donation website etf615.com that the goal is 6.15 Bitcoin for a hat tip to American HODL, which I know is not going to happen because sats are precious. But if you feel like spending and replacing and giving a generous donation, the Bitcoin thing's there. But other than that, I am just humbled and thankful and blessed to have made a lot of great friends and to have found Bitcoin. So yeah, if you're interested in what I'm working on, it's A Boy Named Sue podcast. My Twitter handle is Mr. Sue, MRPSEU. And other than that, Cedric, I really enjoyed being on this call with you, man.
Most def, man. We'll write out to more of your words and then we'll rock out to your tune. So if, you know, to help writing the soundtrack to the Sound Money Revolution, you can help write it too and be a part of the process by heading over to etf615.com. If you want to help, just look for the BTC Pay Server button on the page. The team over there is truly doing Satoshi's work and are real rock stars by truly making Bitcoin digital cash. No matter how this thing shakes out, Phil will feel truly blessed and forever grateful to anybody who thinks his music is even worth anything. As Gigi says, Bitcoin changes you before you change it. And Phil can vouch for that. He is definitely not the same person he was a year ago. And Bitcoin has changed him for the better by expanding his curiosity on the inner workings of the world and has humbled him by lowering his time preference and meeting so many wonderful people in this passionate community. Saying that he is truly thankful for all this would be an understatement. As good Austrians, we all know that value is subjective. Let's spread the word. Let's make it fun. Let's have a party at the edge of the world where everyone is invited. At the end of the day, Bitcoin doesn't care who you are. It just is. And that's why it works for everyone. Let's get down to business. Let's get weird and let's end the Fed, or at least just opt out, buy Bitcoin and rock out to BitRock Freedom Tunes. Stay humble, sack sats, and thank you. This has been so dope, Phil. Peace.
Peace.
Self-sovereignty, abate ourselves to bankruptcy. Which bubble's about to burst? This can't get any. The standard.